At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Great Scott, welcome movie buffs to another electrifying episode of the Silver Screen Podcast. I'm your regular host, Mike, such is my density. I'm here and I am joined by my usual co-host, whose behind the scenes research makes time travel seem like a walk in the park, TK.
Jesus Christ, Mike, this is heavy.
Why is everything so heavy, TK? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational field? Anyway. But yeah, hold on to your flux capacitors, folks. As you will have gathered, today we are looking at the movie Back to the Future on this Silver Screen Podcast original. But we are not alone. We have not one, but two special guests joining us eventually. One of them's here. One's running a little late, but don't worry about that. And they're straight from the Pasty Sheep Nerd Bible Podcast, the dynamic duo of George, who will be with us later, and Connor, who's here right now. Hi, Connor.
Hi. Hello, buttheads.
Hello.
are you listening to butthead?
Safe to say that you've parked the DeLorean outside, and George, I'm presuming, is on his skateboard, desperately trying to catch up to get here. So you're ready for the nostalgia trip that is Back to the Future. Yeah. So yeah, buckle up, grab your hoverboard. No, wait, that's the sequel. And get ready to journey through time, dissect, discuss, and undoubtedly geek out over the beloved 80s classic. And remember, if you suddenly find yourself face-to-face with your teenage parents, just play it cool and don't disrupt the space-time continuum. Easy, right? Anyway, so before we get into the heavy business that DK alluded to about behind the scenes, I always like to kind of start off things with a little bit of a background of how you came to this movie and the first time you saw it. And can you remember what that was and what your initial impressions of it were? And since you're our guest, Connor, I'm going to come to you and ask you first about that.
So I can't honestly recall the first time I properly watched the film. But it actually, the first real time I was familiar with Back to the Future was, are you guys familiar with Telltale Games at all? Like you, the audience, also the two of you.
Yeah.
So before they got popular and did the Walking Dead game and Game of Thrones and Borderlands and etc., and then eventually went bankrupt, they did a Back to the Future game, and essentially it was kind of a sequel to the trilogy. Essentially it was Back to the Future 4, and it follows up from all three of the movie installments. But for that game, because I had no prior knowledge before that, I then sort of got out of my way and watched at least the original, and then luckily stuck around to watch the trilogy just to play Back to the Future 4 the game, essentially.
Weird.
But then, I say, this was a good few years ago, maybe 2017, 18 time, maybe. It's when I first really sat down and watched them.
That's weird. I thought it would have been way more ingrained in your life than that, but okay.
Well, no, I don't mean to beat around the bush, but there's so many things, Michael. If I could turn back time, pun intended, and make things part of my childhood, I really would. I wish Back to the Future was one of them, because it is amazing. It is one of the best.
That's fair enough. That's a different angle to come at it from, which at least I think is interesting, because you never know, maybe people in the audience, they either haven't discovered it or discover it, you know, later in life, so... Cool, fair enough.
Yeah, but honestly, I could say that about everything I've really wanted to. I didn't watch this until I was 15, 16, then in my mid-20s like I am now. Oh, don't hate me. Don't go at me in the comments, please.
There are plenty of things I didn't get to until I went to university and people were like, you've never seen, you know, X film? Yeah, and I was like, sorry. But anyway, so DK, I'm assuming you're going to be a very different experience. So what was yours?
Yeah, before I do though, I've got to give a shout out. That game was freaking amazing.
Really? Oh, I didn't even know you knew it.
Yeah, I played that and then went back and played it and made sure I platinumed it all, because it really was good. It was a worthy successor to the trilogy. I didn't see it when it first came out. It kind of came and went, and everybody was kind of making a big deal out of it. And I'll be completely honest with you, it never really appealed to me. And then... a few years later, a friend who I went to school with had a birthday party, and his parents hired out the cinema. And so he got to pick which movie he wanted to watch, and it was Back to the Future. So, he invited a bunch of his friends there, and that's when I saw it for the first time. And I'll give him a shout-out, Christian, if you're listening. Probably not, but cheers for that, dude, because he introduced me to this film. And, really liked it. Strangely enough... didn't see the second one at the cinema, saw the third one at the cinema. That was confusing as hell. But, that's where I first saw it.
Fair enough. I didn't see any of them at the cinema. I mean, I was two when the first one came out for a start, so that wasn't going to have happened. And I cannot remember the first time I saw this movie. It's just kind of, it's one of those things that's always been part of my life. But like we've discussed on a few other things, DK, I know for a fact it would have been on TV that I first saw it. When I was like really, really young, and I probably saw it on TV a load of times before, like eventually buying it and watching it properly and stuff. And for some reason, I'm almost certain it was like ITV with adverts. You know what I mean? That's the memory I have, is like watching this and it taking like 2.5 hours and cutting out for commercial breaks annoyingly every so often. So
that does sound familiar.
Yeah. So it probably was like that was my first earliest experiences. And I liked it straight away, but like you, I like it more and more now as time goes by. You know, safe to say now I'm, you know, very much a Back to the Future super fan. Spoiler alert for the reviews. But if I tell you I've got the framed poster in my living room, I've got a toy DeLorean, a keyring replica of the Out of Time license plate, a keyring of the hoverboard, the complete visual history, the trilogy on Blu-ray, and the original movie on limited edition 4K steelbook with Japanese artwork and free poster. And
right. That's literally just... take a drink, everyone, just for the fact that it's mentioned this 4K. We're not, 10 minutes into this thing, and we're already starting to get the audience drunk. But I think I know which way that your score is going to go on this.
Yeah, but I should say that's just the stuff that's in my current eye line. So, safe to say I know quite a lot about this movie, and, it's one of those that just becomes... It's weird because it's kind of the... Not to sound too, you know, offensive, but it's kind of one of the holy trinity of movies, because I have the three of them behind me on my wall framed, and those are Jurassic Park, Terminator 2, and Back to the Future. Those are, like, the three movies to know me. The top three of my life, you know, kind of. We're going to jump into the behind the scenes thing, which is the purview of you, DK. Before we start that, I just want to say for you listeners, there's way too much to get into with this movie. We could make a series just about Back to the Future. So we probably will leave some things out. We're going to try and be as comprehensive as we can. But I encourage you to kind of do your own research and deep dive into the film, because there's so much information out there, and I thoroughly recommend all of the special features, the various documentaries that have been made, the kind of behind-the-scenes books, the official visual history, etc. It's fascinating, and it's as entertaining as the movie, the kind of behind-the-scenes story of the making of it. So, consider this a kind of, you know, a cover-my-back disclaimer for if we miss anything out, but also a nice little direct over there to recommend. Like I said, it's one of those films that the making of it is absolutely fascinating in its own right. So, with that said... DK, you have the behind-the-scenes information, I believe, or as much, hopefully, as we can get.
Well,
to.
You know, as usual. I mean, as you say, there is so much for this one. So I've been as selective as I can with these things, but you know, I'll give you a bit of a top loader thing, and then I'll sprinkle some bits here and there as we go.
Yeah.
But sure. Gale and Zemeckis, they conceived the idea for Back to the Future in 1980. They were desperate for a successful film after numerous collaborative failures, which I'm not going to go into. But the project was rejected more than 40 times by various studios because it wasn't considered raunchy enough to compete with the successful comedies of the era. A development deal was secured with Universal Pictures following Zemeckis' success directing Romancing the Stone. Fox was the first choice to portray Marty. He was unavailable, however, so as you know, pretty much any fan to this will know, Eric Stoltz was cast instead. Shortly after principal photography began in November 84, Zemeckis determined Stoltz was just not right for the part and made the concessions necessary to hire Fox, including refilming scenes already shot with Stoltz and adding $4 million to the budget. Back to the Future was filmed in and around California and on sets at Universal Studios and concluded the following April. After highly successful test screenings, the release date was brought forward to July 3rd, 1985, giving the film more time in theatres during the busiest period of the theatrical year. The change resulted in a rushed post-production schedule and some incomplete special effects. Back to the Future was a critical commercial success, earning $381 million to become the highest-grossing film of 1985 worldwide. Critics praised the story, humorous elements, and the cast, particularly Fox, Lloyd, Thompson, and Glover. It received multiple award nominations and won an Academy Award, 3 Saturn Awards, and a Hugo Award. Its theme song, The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News, was also a huge success. It's now considered by critics and audiences to be one of the greatest science fiction films ever, and among the best films ever made. In 2007, the United States Library of Congress selected it for preservation in the National Film Registry. The film was followed by 2 sequels, obviously Back to the Future 2 and Back to the Future 3, spurred by the film's dedicated fan following and effect on popular culture. Universal Studios launched a multimedia franchise, which now includes video games, theme park rides, an animated TV series, a stage musical. Its enduring popularity has prompted numerous books about its production, documentaries and commercials. However, the rights to the film and its sequels are owned by Zemeckis and Gale, who revealed in a 2015 interview that no reboot or remake of the film would be authorised during their lifetime.
Good stuff, yeah. Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, of course, the guys responsible, the co-writers of the movie, and we know Zemeckis obviously directed it, so yeah. What was I going to say? I have a couple of things to add without hoping, hopefully, I'm not going to step on anything that you wanted to say here. But I should add that despite the ending of the first movie, there was no initial plan to make any sequels, it was just intended as a quick gag ending. So you know, they weren't setting up Back to the Future Part 2, and either Gale or Zemeckis have said since, if they were planning on setting up a sequel, they wouldn't have had Jennifer get in the car, which is why they just knock her out immediately when they get to the future in part 2, because, yeah, nothing for her to really do there. So, yeah, and I believe we could be joined by one Calvin Klein here. So, yeah, please welcome, better late than never, George to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello, George. George, sorry about that. Just... 1 second before we go any further, I have to issue you with a tardy slip. Slacker. just not good enough.
Is that Strickland? Jesus, has that guy never had hair?
No white ever amounted to anything in the history of Podcast Valley.
Well, history's going to change.
Yes, awesome. Yeah. Welcome to the podcast, George. We've kind of done our little bits of intro, but we were waiting for you to ask you the question that we all answered. So I'm going to pose it to you now, and hopefully you'll have a decent, entertaining-ish answer. So the big question is, when was the first time you watched Back to the Future? Can you really remember it? And what were your initial thoughts on seeing it for the first time?
All right, very good question. I think I was about 5 or 6 when I first watched Back to the Future. Mm. Because it's one of the films that my dad loves, and like, you know, he's got me into a lot of films. Like, he's the reason that this is you know, one of the, like, my most favorite films of all time. Like, I had the VHS copies of the trilogy, I've had the DVDs, I've had the Blu-ray, I've got the 4K now, I've watched this countless times. I just remember, like, just sort of being blown away. Like, you know, like, when you see a film at a young age and you know that it's sort of left an impression on you.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think I was the same.
It kind of washed over me and just, like, completely, like, I was just in awe of it. Like, it's such a good film on its own. It works well in arguably one of the best trilogies of all time. I'd say that it just is it's such neat storytelling, like, for it to be singular and the way that it then weaves back into the other two, like the fact that they are a continuous loop kind of thing. But I just love it. Michael J. Fox is my hit. I used to dress as Marty McFly, like, incessantly, like, to a point where it is just embarrassing. It gets brought up all the time. but I love it. And it's like, Michael J. Fox is, like, legend, one of, like, my first, like, heroes in, like, film and television.
Yeah, see him, actually, weirdly enough.
Like, I love the man dearly. I know that, you know, when the day comes that he is no longer on this mortal plane, I will be inconsolable. But, you know, like, I love this guy. I love the film. The direction's great. The music is just stellar. Like, everything just kind of...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to it all.
It's like the stars align, really. I just love this film so much. I'm not going to be much use. I'm just, like, you know, I've had 3 pints.
That's fine.
I'm very happy. This is the best day of my life, guys. Thanks for having me.
So I knew that you had, like, a huge connection to Back to the Future, because we were saying it's kind of weird that Connor and you are kind of polar opposites, because Connor only recently, like, as early as 2015, I think, saw it for the first time.
Yeah,
and I
was 15, like, 16. Yeah. It's all because of the game. Like I say, it's all because of a game. That's why I watch any movies, because of the game, or because of a film or something I haven't watched. That's why. All because of the game.
Well, because we peer pressure you into it.
Yes.
No, I had this watched and knowledge. Like, I even went out of my way to watch a sodding musical of it. And as I say, this is even basically made for a musical. So the fact that it sort of went, I've seen it something right. as not intended as a musical and loved it. Like, I do want to go to the theatre more often than I do anyway. But I just, I loved the musical production of it. It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah.
It's rare that, like, well, so much media has come out of this franchise and all of it is, like, good, like, decent, well-made stuff. I'd argue there's nothing really that's come out of this. Even the weird, like, animated series with the weird Doc Brown children. Like, even that's good.
On the subject of kind of things that have spawned from Back to the Future, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but a few friends of mine years and years ago went to a, like, live event of Back to the Future where it was, like, you acted out the movie before a big screening of it, and you were all given, like, a character. And you had to, like, you know, you had to design the odd bit of prop or whatever for your character. And then you'd go and you'd act out the bits and pieces in this, like, makeshift Hill Valley courthouse area and whatever. And, one of my friends was asked to be Goldie Wilson, which obviously isn't a huge role, but, you know, they've got to have everybody do everything. And he was just, even he was so thrilled to be making the, like, vote Goldie for mayor, still, like, props and stuff. Just
mayor.
Because the movie is, so beloved. It's just like, I'd be anybody, you know.
That's cool. When was that, Mike?
Oh, it was about 6 or 7 years ago now. It was a while back.
Wow.
It was like a Fathom Events or something or other, but yeah.
That's cool, man.
But, I mean, it just goes to show how beloved the film is, really. You know, it's
it is.
Like I said, especially I think for our generation. I say our generation as if me, you, and DK and Connor are on 4 completely different generations. But yeah, but so anybody that grew up in the
80s, generation.
We are one generation.
We are the
future generation.
We are the definition of Generation Z, Generation Zemeckis.
Well, one of us is back. Absolutely. One of us is 2. One of us is the, and one of us is the future.
I'll be 2.
I'll be back.
No, leave it in the comments below. Leave it in the comments below.
I'll be the Old West.
Are we mentioning the sequels, or are we just focusing on this?
No, no, we're focusing on the first one. I mean, that, we've kind of said as much as I was going to, which is obviously there were successful sequels made, and I did sort of let the audience know there was no intention to make a sequel at first, despite the ending of the first one. It was just intended as a quick gag. It wasn't, like, setting up anything. So,
as your Back to the Future official fact checker, you are correct.
Jesus.
Thank you for that. Kind of covered as much as we're going to for the BTS. As you say, we're going to sprinkle other things in as we hit the other sections. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that we just break our notes for ease down into sections like writing and plot, direction, acting, visual effects, etc. And we kind of touch on things just to give us some form of structure like that. But, you know, if we do get derailed, which does happen, we often just go with the flow. So, yeah. So I have a couple of things on the writing and the plot that I wanted to bring up before I hand over to UTK, I'm presuming, to have a little bit more information as well.
No worries.
So the first thing that I will note is that the University of Southern California Film School's writing classes use the screenplay for Back to the Future as the model of, quote, the perfect screenplay. So you really can't get better than that in terms of accolades for writing.
High praise indeed.
The only other thing that I have is like a humorous story about the making of the film and kind of the way that Sid Sheinberg is the guy who the producer of the film was kind of interfering with silly things. And he got his way with a lot of things, like I think changing Professor Brown to Doc Brown was one of the things he insisted on doing, and just little things that didn't have a huge effect. But he insisted that he didn't like the title Back to the Future. And, you know, originally the movie was called different things. I think one of the titles was Spaceman from Pluto or something, which he was trying to advocate for. So they were basically, they were given this memo from the money guy, and Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale were like, you know, sitting there sweating over like, what do we do? He's, you know, we can't change the title. The title's brilliant. And what do we do? So Steven Spielberg supposedly wrote back a memo to Sid Sheinberg that just said, Sid, thank you for your humorous memo. Read the title. How ridiculous. We all got a great big laugh out of it. Brilliant joke, Steven Spielberg. And he's like, he's going to be too proud to acknowledge that he meant it seriously if we took it as a joke. So sure enough, like, he got that memo and just dropped it. And the title stayed as Back to the Future, which I just love. That's a perfect example of how to deal with people with ego, I think, isn't it, really?
Well done, Spielberg.
Exactly, yeah. So that's what I had anyway. What about you, DK? Any sort of information before we hit the kind of thoughts and feelings and opinions?
Yeah, I've got a bit for this. Inspiration for the film, it largely stems from Bob Gale discovering his father's high school yearbook and wondering whether he would have been friends with his father as a teenager. As I mentioned earlier, it was rejected 44 times. When Zemeckis was trying to sell it, one of the companies he approached was Disney, who turned it down because they thought the premise of a mother falling in love with a son was too risque for a film under their banner. But Disney was the only company to consider the film too risque after all the other companies said the film was not risque enough.
More incest.
In April 2020, Back to the Future screenwriter Bob Gale finally decided to explain the plot hole question about why Marty's parents did remember him as the kid in the high school who got them together. He told The Hollywood Reporter, bear in mind that George and Lorraine only knew Marty slash Calvin for 8 days when they were 17, and they didn't even see him every one of those 8 days. So many years later, they still might remember that interesting kid who got them together on their first date. But I would ask anyone to think back on their own high school days and ask themselves how well they remember a kid who might have been at their school for even a semester, or someone you went out with just one time.
I think if you're starting to sort of, if you're overly thinking about this film, it's one of those rare occasions where I'm going to see it. You really have to kind of mystery
get the Joel GIF out.
It's just a movie. Just enjoy it. If you overthink it, it's, you know, theoretical time travel stuff and whatever. You're going to give yourself a headache. I'm sure there'll be things that fall apart if you want to nitpick it. I don't care. Basically, at the end of the day, it works for what it needs to. It works on a surface level. And I never question stupid stuff like, oh, how come they didn't, you know, recognize that it was their son all them years ago? Like you said, I mean, who cares? It doesn't really matter. Yeah. Timey-wimey shenanigans, whatever.
It's the ultimate timey-wimey movie. Let it go. Just let it go, people. Let it go.
In the original script, Marty's playing rock and roll at the dance caused a riot, which had to be broken up by police. This combined with Marty accidentally tipping Doc off to the secret ingredient that made Time Machine work, Coca-Cola, caused history to change. When Marty got back to the 80s, he found that it was now the 1950s conception of that decade, with air cars, which we eventually got in the sequel,
and whatnot, and all of which was invented by Doc Brown and running on Coca-Cola. Marty also discovered that rock and roll was never invented, and he dedicates himself to starting the delayed cultural revolution. Meanwhile, his dad digs out the newspaper from the day after the dance and sees his son in the picture of the riot. And there was also a plot line where, in order to fund the time machine, Doc and Marty were selling bootleg videos. It was removed at Universal's request, as they did not want to be seen as promoting movie piracy.
Yeah, I do remember reading about that. I don't know. Again, I'm probably going to end up stepping on you because I'm sure you probably were going to mention this, but I'm assuming you did know that the initial idea for the ending was completely different, and they weren't going to use a DeLorean for a start as the time machine.
Yeah.
They wanted something that was stationary and could be dragged around, and the end of the movie, which will sound very familiar to you now, was going to be that basically a fridge gets pulled to like a nuclear test site and a nuclear bomb explodes and propels Marty in fridge back through time. So yeah, apparently Steven Spielberg vetoed it because he said, you know, he didn't want kids crawling into fridges and stuff, and it was too dangerous, and presumably also he wanted to use it for the terrible fourth Indiana Jones movie a few years down the line. So
terrible fourth movie, still better than the fifth one.
Well, I mean, yeah. I'm gonna basically say, for me, I think one of the things that I know about this movie is that it works because on two levels, it's kind of two different things to different people. Like, it's a basic teen slacker kind of comedy, feel goodish kind of movie, but it's also like really quite hard sci-fi time travel stuff in there as well. And I think they gel really well in a way that could have been problematic if it hadn't. You've got to give it kudos. And so much of the writing is to kind of thread these things together and little hints and bits and pieces. So I'm going to throw it open anyway and just ask, do you guys have any initial thoughts on the writing or favourite parts of the way the film is written or moments?
I like the little touches. They don't really dwell on a great deal, but if you're watching, you know it's there, like the Twin Pines Lone Pine Mall.
Yes, that joke. Shall we explain that for anybody who hasn't seen it or hasn't quite aware of it yet?
Yeah, go for it, dude.
So basically, the mall that they go to is called the Twin Pines Mall at the start of the movie. But then obviously we know Marty takes the DeLorean back and crashes into the farm of Peabody. And he was the guy that was growing the pines. So Marty basically destroys one of the two pine trees. So when Marty goes back to the future, at the end of the movie and runs to the mall to catch up with Doc, it's not even really focused on. But if you look, the Twin Pines Mall is now the Lone Pine Mall, because there's only one pine tree because Marty destroyed the other one. And it's just like little moments like that are just absolute genius. I just love it. And I'm with you completely on that one. What one of the other ones I should mention, because I kind of alluded to it there, is the fact that he crashes into the barn of old farmer Peabody, whose son is called Sherman. I see.
Oh, shit. I never picked up on that one.
Yeah, that was deliberate as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, was that anything else you wanted to shout out to here? Because there's so many cool little moments and stuff like that, isn't there, really?
Yeah, just the little things of when he turns up, you know, I'm Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan. Just little comedic moments. Like, I love all that kind of stuff.
I'll mention a few things that I kind of wanted to shout out, just little references and references that pay off in other ways and stuff later. But I'm going to come to our guests then and ask George or Connor, whichever one wants to go first, anything that stands out in the writing for you guys? It doesn't have to be like a little moment. It can be a bigger thing if you want or whatever.
Got some stuff in the writing, but do you guys know where the one bit in the movie is from the original stuff shot with Eric Stoltz?
I do. It's when he's running to the mall because it's from behind, so you can't really supposedly tell.
There is another bit with the punch.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Because the lighting is slightly different. Thomas F. Wilson looks slightly more younger and refreshed because it would obviously have been earlier in the production cycle. And he said in interviews a couple of times that they never reshot that stuff with Michael. Eric Stoltz's fist and the back of his head.
I will say that I was surprised. Like, I obviously knew, like any Back to the Future, you know, self-respecting fan, that Stoltz was hired first and they filmed for a while. But it's not until watching documentaries and reading the visual history book that I realized just how much they had actually filmed with Stoltz. Like, it's a solid half of the movie. You know what I mean? It was filmed and they just scrapped it, paid him off at full expense. But I have to say, I don't want to get too far into it because it's for the acting, but I've got to see correct decision bringing in Michael J. Fox like for that. So, yeah.
Would you be interested to see, obviously, like we can't, but would you have been interested to see what they had of the Stultz version?
Well, I've seen clips and bits and pieces, and it's just not very good. So I can kind of see why.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see why
he
they
plays
were like
it completely differently, and he doesn't have that charm that Fox does.
Exactly. Although I will say that this is kind of how nice of a guy Michael J. Fox is, and it's kind of a funny story, is that somebody asked him once about, like, what was it that you brought different to Stultz and what did you think was better or whatever, and he was quite kind of, you know, shy about it and was like, oh, I couldn't possibly say it's one of those roles that I could play and he couldn't, but in fairness to him, I could never have played the drug dealer in Pulp Fiction. like, all right, fair news.
What a guy. Yeah. What a hero.
So, Connor, what about you? I mean, you haven't really said a lot, so, and obviously you are newest to this film. Did you notice anything in the writing that you especially responded to that you wanted to shout out?
I mean, yeah, like you say, the Twin Pines, I just read Twin Pines. I thought Twin Peaks, but I mean, I know that's got absolutely nothing to do with That's the Future. Yeah. But I'm like, Twin Pines, Twin Peaks, oh, that's not convenient, even though Twin Peaks is after That's the Future. But that's where my mind went to. I can't think of anything clever or fancy, as you guys have mentioned, in that sort of department, but I just think of key scenes or key moments, I just love any, like the scene with Marty and George in the cafe and Biff doing his usual like, what are you looking at, Bubbard? And when I think of that Future, that scene is the first thing that comes to my mind, is always that cafe scene, the bar scene, Marty's
even that
hand,
though is like you say it's nothing stood out, but even that though I would say is something that stands out as clever, because it is literally like the way that mirrors exactly what like older George and Biff's relationship was. It's genius.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, we take it for granted because we don't think of, we just know of it and it's there, but it's really clever. They're seeing basically the same thing. You know,
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If I hand it in your handwriting, I'm going to get fired. If I hand it in your handwriting, I'm going to get kicked out of school. And it's the same thing. And I love those little echoes. And even like when Marty and George are like moving their heads onto their hand in the counter and they both do the exact same choreography.
Yeah. Right. I love them visual shortcuts. Like there's like a lot of films would like you would see them as lazy, but it's so well done. It's like you say, it's seamless. Like them moving together the two scenes basically being exactly the same, but just, you know, different times. And absolutely. I like sort of the reflection of how that then plays out with the end, like when it comes back round and like he's managed to, you know, make his dad like stand up for himself. So his dad is then, you know, provided a better life for him. Obviously, Marty's not had the pleasure of living that life because, you know, he went asleep poor and he woke up rich. So, you know, them's the breaks. Yeah.
Again, that's another thing you could analyze to death about, like, how come everybody else knows things have changed or doesn't know things have changed and Marty does? And does that mean there's another Marty that was from that timeline that just died? Or don't think about it.
You get it in a lot of, not to talk about it all the time, but you get it in a lot of Doctor Who, though, don't you? You get, like, if you're there, like, you're the eye of the storm, so you're, like, the, you know, the only ones that will know sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, because he is sort of like the linchpin of going through time and space. Him and Doc would be the only ones that would remember it, because it's not like his dad and his mum went back and forward. So I can forgive it for that. I think it's ironic. Like obviously you said, DK, it was rejected over 44 times and yet its script is used as a perfect script. So like these people obviously in the '80s were sleeping on it hard.
No, I wanted to mention a few things. Cause like I said, I love the way that it uses the time travel concept cleverly for little gags and Easter eggs and stuff. So, like, the first one that I've written here is the idea that when Doc of the Past asks Marty who the president is, it's Ronald Reagan. And again, you'd only really know this if you lived through the 80s, but yeah, the idea that like the famed cowboy actor Ronald Reagan was the president is ludicrous. It's just ridiculous.
They actually like had to get permission from the White House for that.
President.
Yeah, it is a bit like, but no, yeah, I remember they had to get permission, you're saying, from the White House, DK, but supposedly the president really liked that. They were worried about it, but he said he found it really amusing. He just didn't like the reference to Jane Wyman, whose name apparently was forbidden to be spoken in the White House with his second wife. So, yeah, but that's just, it's so clever. You know, the idea of, well, of course he's got to be an actor. Look, everything's on TV and whatnot. And just little things as well, like when he's at the diner and he's not quite sure how to deal with the 50s. So you get like, I'll have a tab. Well, I can't give you a tab unless you order something. Okay, I'll have a Pepsi free. If you want a Pepsi, buddy, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah, love that. Can I just get some of that sugar?
Yeah, exactly. So he just gives him like coffee. Or something. I just love all that. And I love the idea that, like you said, Goldie Wilson as a character, it's such a minor thing, but the guy's like, you know, oh, I'm going to amount to something one day. I'm not going to be stuck here. And then Marty's like, yeah, you're going to be the mayor. And that is what actually inspires him to be like, yeah, Goldie Wilson, the mayor.
Is that a bit of a paradox that he only becomes mayor because Marty has seen him be mayor, so he makes him become mayor by saying he's the mayor?
Maybe. I mean, if you want to see it that way, it's one of those things, isn't it? But I mean, there's things that it kind of hints at that, you know, or there's some things that are fate or they're just going to happen, like, but they use it for a gag, like the Uncle Joey, you better get used to those bars. He's just so obsessed with his playpen. You
know? I've seen this one. How can you see this? Brand new. I saw it on a rerun.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a rerun. You'll find out.
Precisely. So, no, I mean, I love all those little things, but in terms of the actual kind of plot idea, and again, we'd be here all day because it is all just so good, but I love the idea that it sets up so many things with cool exposition. You know, like Save the Clock Tower, it was struck by lightning. That's going to become important later. Mm-hmm. The idea of plutonium, you know, that's relevant. That's going to be, you know, what ultimately leads to Doc getting killed and having to be saved. And even little things like,
he actually uses. Sorry, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. But even like Marty at the beginning saying like, oh, Jennifer, I'd love to have a truck like that. And then when he, you know, comes back to the improved timeline, he has that truck. So it's like, yeah, okay. Everything's there for a reason and everything kind of feeds back into each other, which I just...
About calling him a walking paradox, he's a walking jinx box, because look at him. Looking at the end. Everything he says, it then magically happens. Or was it always fated to happen?
Oh, yes, that's the thing, though. It kind of like, it's another thing that I like about the movie is that it never seems over the top, even though it puts so many obstacles in his way that he has to overcome by the end of like, oh, the wires come loose. Now the car won't start. Now I'm, you know, Doc won't take the letter, so I'm going to go back early. But nope, the car won't start again. So now I have to run to catch up with him. And it's just like, it works really well because you're at such high tension and so like with the movie and engaged in it that it's just like,
I think it's paced to perfection.
Yeah, completely, exactly my point. So, that's really all I've got about the writing without getting too far into just describing the movie. But as you said, I do like this idea.
Act one, scene one.
But no, I do. It's total wish fulfillment, but there is something nice about the idea of like, if you could get your dad to stand up to Biff finally, once and forever, you know, everything will be hunky dory, I guess. So,
apart from your mum trying to come on to you. Cheers, everyone.
Well, let's not get too far into that one.
Let's not get too far into that.
Indeed. That was one of the other quotes that I found actually in my research was that obviously we know that they finally kiss, like Lorraine comes on to Marty and then says, oh, it's all wrong. It feels like I'm kissing my brother. And I think it was Bob Gale says, thankfully, nobody in the audience questioned how she would know what that feels like because they just don't want the relationship to happen. So they accept it.
Oh, God, yeah.
I can't say much on the writing apart from how good it is. Like, I feel like I'm just going to keep saying the same thing as you guys. Like, it's just, it's so tight.
I would.
So well paced.
Yeah, such a tight script.
One thing I should probably have, I don't know if this is writing or direction, but one thing I should shout out because it's my avatar is it's such genius shorthand for the kind of changing of time to use the photograph and Marty and his siblings like fading in and out, because that's such a crazy concept to try and explain. And you've referenced it already there, George, like Doctor Who's tried that so many times of like, I'll take you to your time and show you that it's different and whatever. And this little shorthand photograph of like, we're disappearing. That's what you're competing with. If you disappear because your parents haven't got together, you're not there. And it's so simple and yet so effective, you know?
It is. It really is. And it's used a lot now, I think, in film since. And Back to the Future, obviously, not just culturally, but it's like it's such a reference point for, like, how time travel's been done in other films. Obviously, the whole thing in Endgame where they take the, like, so everything in Back to the Future is bullshit, because obviously the actual scientific paradox.
But how dare they?
How it would be your future would be your past kind of thing. Like, it's so influential on the rest of, like, the sci-fi time travel stuff that's come since.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's one of these films that I think, if you've not seen Back to the Future, you've at least consumed it by osmosis. Like, there is so much of it, like, in modern day.
And not to keep harping on, but again, this was another quote that I saw from Robert Zemeckis this time, when he's writing, he writes the afterword in the visual dictionary, and he says that, like, he's so proud of Back to the Future because it's one of those things that culturally has hit everybody. Like, everybody knows, whether they've seen it or not, who those characters are, what the basic plot beats are, you know. He says Back to the Future has been brought up by, you know, people in politics right the way through to, you know, people on the street that reference it as just a shorthand for various things, and... Yeah, I mean, it is one of those cultural phenomenons, I guess. So I'll move us on anyway to the acting now, then, because, like I said, we could be here all day praising the plot, acting. But suffice to say, we think it's good. So, so DK, do you have anything else on the acting other than the whole Eric Stoltz, Michael J. Fox situation?
Oh, do I? yeah, I've got a fair bit here. It might be better if we go on to... I read out whatever it is for whichever actor.
Okay.
I mean, I can start with Michael J. Fox and then get on to... Yeah, so... Well, Michael J. Fox is on record as saying that Marty's being characterised as riding skateboards, chasing girls and interest in playing music with hopes of becoming a rock star was the exact same way he was during his own high school days. When he joined the Screen Actors Guild, he added J to his name because the short version was already taken by a prolific character actor, Michael Fox. This elder Fox starred in Science Fiction Theatre, the TV show George McFly gives as his reason for passing on the enchantment under the sea dance. Now, he'd always been the first choice for Marty, as we know. He was unavailable due to scheduling conflicts with his work and family ties, as his co-star, Meredith Baxter, was pregnant at the time. Fox was carrying a lot more of the show than usual, and the show's producer, Gary David Goldberg, simply could not afford to let Fox go. Zemeckis and Gale then cast, as we know, Eric Stoltz, based on his performance in Mask. After 6 weeks of filming, Zemeckis and Gale felt that Stoltz wasn't right for the part, and Stoltz agreed. By this stage, Baxter was back fully on the Family Ties show, and Goldberg agreed to let Fox go to make the film, working out a schedule with Fox to fulfill his commitment to both projects. So every day during production, he drove straight to the movie set after taping of the show was finished and averaged about 5 hours of sleep per day.
Yeah, I remember reading that he was basically filming Family Ties during the day, Back to the Future at night, and then would get, like, maybe one day off at the weekend.
The bulk of the production, was filmed from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. with the daylight scenes filmed on weekends. Reshooting Stoltz's scenes added $3 million to the budget. Stoltz would later play the title character in The Fly 2, where his character's first name was Martin. So he went from Marty McFly to Marty the Fly.
Oh, you did not.
In 2010, during a cast reunion, Michael J. Fox said that strangers still call him McFly constantly. He said that the most remarkable instance was when he was in a remote jungle in South Asian country Bhutan, located between China and India in the Eastern Himalayas. A group of Buddhist monks passed him, and one of them looked at Fox and said, "Marty McFly!" Now, during his time on the film,
Matt Berry.
during his time on the film, and being a method actor, Eric Stoltz refused to answer to any other name but that of his character, Marty McFly. When Christopher Lloyd was told that Stoltz was to be replaced, he asked, "Who's Eric Stoltz?" And after further explanation, added, "Oh, I really thought his name was Marty." According to Tom Wilson, who isn't the biggest fan of Eric Stoltz.
I have information about that as to why.
Yeah, the only time that the method acting Stoltz would break character was when he would actively flirt with Leah Thompson in between takes. I'll go on that now with Tom Wilson. He almost had his collarbone broken in the scene when Marty and Biff are about to fight in the cafeteria, as Eric Stoltz roughed up Tom for real. take after take, despite repeated requests from Tom to tone down the aggression. Tom later said he was about to return the favour during filming of the car park scene outside the dance by giving him a real punch. Unfortunately, Eric Stoltz was fired before that filming could take place.
So he didn't miss his chance.
No.
Awesome. Cool. So, yeah, I mean, that's dealt with quite a few of the people. I haven't really got much to say other than to say, I've already mentioned, I think Michael J. Fox is this movie. I think that is the absolutely inspired casting. I fully kind of agree with them, even though I know it cost, like, say, $3 million to reshoot plus whatever other, because I know it was also a hefty amount to pay for, because they had to give Stoltz his full salary and pay for his hotel for the 6 weeks and everything as well. So it actually ended up costing a heck of a lot more, but I think it was the right decision. Yeah. And like I said, Michael J. Fox makes the movie. He was my hero when I was younger and still now much the same as George. It was like, there's something relatable and charming about him when you're a young man, I guess. And
project yourself onto him as a character. I think at any age as well, just like, obviously at six, like, I'm not skateboarding, like, on the back of a pickup and, you know, trying to pick up girls at high school, but like, you see just that, like, he is such, I don't want to say like a black, like, he's not bland, like, as a character, that's not what I'm trying to, but he's such a sort of blank canvas in terms of, like, he's got enough about him as a character, and he's so compelling. But you can literally just feel yourself on him. That sounds weird. You can literally
know what you mean,
on Michael J. Fox.
It's easy to identify with him, I think, for anybody, like you said, because
that's the one.
Yeah. But I mean, even because that is his arc is basically like his dad. He starts out as like, oh, I don't think I could handle the rejection. What am I going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And then basically finds his confidence, which, again, it's wish fulfillment. We all want that. So that's
he's kind of the opposite end, isn't he? Like, he's just as uncool, but he thinks he is cool, kind of thing.
Exactly. But, so you mentioned obviously Thomas F. Wilson, who plays Biff, who I have to say I think is underrated and by all accounts is a really nice guy, unlike Biff. And I mean, I mentioned off air, shall we say, that I loved him in Legends of Tomorrow. I think he was great in that, in the role that he had. I'm assuming you would agree with me on that one, Deke.
Definitely. He really was the highlight of that season. But yeah, you say he's a nice guy. Apparently, he drew upon his own personal experiences of being bullied as a kid to create the Biff persona.
Wait, yeah. Who was his Biff?
Yeah, exactly.
Time loop.
Exactly. I did read somewhere, though, that he got asked so much the same questions about Back to the Future that with no malice at all, he basically just had printed out a bunch of cards with, like, frequently asked question answers on them. So instead of dealing with people, he would just go, there you go. I haven't, but I know of it. I haven't heard it.
Shall I play it? Are you going to get copyrighted for this?
No, we...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
We'd get a copyright strike. We know what these guys are like. But no, I think, like I said, he plays it just broad enough, I think, the Biff character. And there'd be more to say if we were dealing with the sequels, because he also, you know, he plays different versions of that character even more so there. But I think he's underrated. And can we move on, or did you have somebody else that you wanted to mention more about?
I mean, if you want to go on to Chris Lloyd, I've got some shit about Chris Lloyd.
I don't have much about Christopher Lloyd, just that I read him saying that he
always wasn't 96.
he wasn't sure about taking the part, and there was almost so many. There's a laundry list of actors which I encourage you to look at, because looking at this list, if you look at some of the people that could have been hired as Doc Brown and what the movie could have been, we're talking like Jeff Daniels, Jeff Goldblum, you know, these
I would fucking pay to see Jeff Goldblum, like,
Jeff Goldblum.
for like children.
Lonnie, we've got to go back to the
future. The future finds a way.
Yeah. Anyway, Christopher Lloyd DK, take it away. Do you want to?
Oh yeah, he originally turned it down, but changed his mind after his wife told him to get off his arse and do it. He was offered it after having worked with producer Neil Canton on The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
So everybody, take a drink.
Take a drink.
His
hunched over look developed when the filmmakers realised the difference in height between Lloyd and Fox. Fox is 5'4", while Lloyd is 6'1". So to compensate for the height difference, Zemeckis used specific blocking where the two often stood far apart at different camera depths. But for close-up, Lloyd would have to hunch over to appear in frame. And he said he always wanted to do one more movie in which Marty and Doc travel in time to ancient Rome.
Actually, I don't have much to say other than Christopher Lloyd is the other half of that equation of like the perfect casting. Yes. He plays that role perfectly. I think again it could be too over the top in places if he hadn't judged it right, and I think it's perfect. And his chemistry with Michael J. Fox again is just there. It's brilliant, and it's one of those other things that I think probably wasn't there with Eric Stoltz. On the subject of kind of, you know, you were mentioning the height difference between Doc and Marty, I will bring up now that I've mentioned Claudia Wells being cast as Jennifer, who does a very good job with a very small role, but only got the role because the actress they had originally cast was too tall for Michael J. Fox. She was cast when Eric Stoltz was in the part. And that actress, if you're curious, is Melora Hardin, who you may know as Jan from The American Office.
So... Wow. That's quite a good fact. Yeah. Also, like, yes, Michael J. Fox is short, but so he's good looking.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't bother me, but you know the way Hollywood works. It's kind of like this actress is. Oh yeah, they're like the leading man.
Those two are the linchmen, though. You are right, Michael, in terms of the fact of like as much as Marty character, like him and like the linchpin of the movie is Doc and Marty's relationship, and if it's not believable, like the whole movie does not work as a concept. Like regardless of the time travel and the flim flam around it.
It's one of those things as well that, like,
two characters.
It should kind of come off as weird, but it never does. When you think of the connotations of like this, 16-year-old boy and this old man hanging out together,
we never question it.
It's just kind of like, no, there's nothing there. So I just have a couple of things. First of all, I have to shout out my man Mark McClure playing Marty's brother, because you know me, he's Jimmy Olsen from all of the Superman films and Supergirl. So
from all of the Jimmy Olsen.
Always get a bit of a thrill from seeing him disappear in a family photo. Crispin Glover apparently was the actual comic genius on set, according to Leah Thompson.
He's fucking laughing. Serial killer vibes, man.
What are you saying, Norman Banks?
But supposedly his genuine nervousness was kind of added something to that character. And without getting into it, obviously he didn't return for the sequels and was very upset with them for using his likeness, and kind of that all went down litigious routes and all kinds of issues. DK, do you have anything from any other people I've mentioned?
Crispin Glover, he claimed to have seen the film only once shortly after its release. In contrast, Christopher Lloyd states that when he stumbles across it on TV, he always sits down and watches it.
Good man.
This was Billy Zane's first on-screen acting gig, though he has no lines. Leah Thompson said when she was a young actress starting out in Hollywood, a famous agent assessed her options for her. She told me, "Here's your career, virgins, whores and mothers." Thompson recalled with a laugh, "And then I realised in Back to the Future, I got to play a virgin, a whore and a mother all in one movie."
Hooray!
When she follows Marty back to Doc's house, she and Doc exchange an awkward greeting. This marks the only on-screen dialogue that Christopher Lloyd and Leah Thompson ever have, though they've appeared together in 6 movies.
One of them Howard the Duck?
No, he's not in Howard the Duck.
Considering how, like, obviously you get these actors to play them at different ages, and how, at the time, prosthetics and stuff isn't what it is now, but like the makeup job is so good on that. Like, you can conceivably see them as like characters in different points of their life, whether it's, you know, young Lorraine in the 50s, original timeline.
I'm kind of with you on that. Like, I didn't, it sounds ridiculous, but I was probably as young as you when I first saw it. And I didn't put two and two together that it was the same actors at the start of the movie that you see when they're younger, you know. Obviously, it's obvious to us now, when you know it, you can see it. But to me, they were so completely different. And I will say, the prosthetics, yes, they're absolutely impressive and they look realistic. But I have to say, one thing they got completely wrong is that now Leah Thompson is older than Lorraine is supposed to be at the start of that movie and still looks damn fine. So, you know, kind of dropped the ball on that one, I guess. That was just my shooting my shot in case Leah Thompson ever listens to this podcast. And
hey,
to be
Neil, she's here right now. Leah, come in.
I mean, I'm not an anthropomorphic duck, but...
I caught her dressed as Howard the Duck with a big net.
Quack. So, yeah, any last thoughts on the acting from anybody then before we move to direction?
Any last words?
Just Crispin Glover. Just Crispin Glover.
Just Crispin Glover.
Yeah, that's all I want to say. Put that on my gravestone, saying Crispin Glover.
He's that probably the most laugh. Sort of out there performance in terms of, like, he's really sort of a caricature-ish sort of portrayal. Because obviously he's the nerdy, scrawny, you know, scared of talking to girls guy. Where everyone else is kind of, they're not sort of bound by one stereotype as you sort of were in a lot of 80s movies, especially when, you know, a lot of movies in the 80s, you know, were made of the love of the stuff in the 50s, which is why you get all the 50s stuff in the time travel. And even that, it's not all stereotypical in terms of the characters, like even with Lorraine, like you get like with Strickland, like, yeah, he's a bit sort of like one note, but there's still more to him. Like, you know, he's drinking in his office at night, you know, has he got a shit life? I don't know. But like, I think Crispin Glover's the only person that could have played him like that.
But yeah.
Crispin Glover, is as weird as he is, my point is, was very good with that performance because by all accounts, he's a right weirdo.
I'm not here to comment on that, but yeah.
And I like Thomas and Thomas F. Wilson, yes, deserves more love because very good.
Nice guy.
Give me the questions.
So I did have one quick thing I wanted to note. I probably should have mentioned it in writing, but I have it under direction, so I'll start us off with that and say that if we have to look for something critical, I should point out that yes, it's a very idealized vision of the 1950s, not only because of, you know, Goldie Wilson being very accepted in his admittedly subservient role, but in 1955, whatever it is, they would not have allowed a black band to play the Battle of the Bands or the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. It would just not have been allowed.
Parts of America, they probably wouldn't let it happen now. So
yeah, exactly. So you kind of have to, it's one of those things where you kind of have to hand wave it away. It's like, well, it's an ideal version of the past as opposed to the realistic one, because
it's how we'd
a
like
lighthearted
the past.
Comedy.
It's how we'd like the past and the future to be.
Exactly.
It's how it should be.
And it gives you that quality kind of, it's your cousin Marvin Berry joke, which I would not want to lose because it's so funny.
Yes.
So.
And the whole music, the music stuff is a bit weird because the film kind of does stop for the band scene.
I love it though. I love
it. Oh, yeah, I love it, especially like the whole thing with him fading away, which is done very well. And the whole George, and then like,
the people that did the film effects actually don't like that scene, by the way. They said they didn't think the hand fading away thing looks convincing, and I'm like, I've never had an issue with it.
No. For the 80s, that's great.
Yeah, daddy-o.
You get the moment, he gets the girl, and it's all, the music swells and everything, and he stands back up, and then he plays Johnny Be Good, and then leaves. Yep. And it's fantastic. Absolutely. Good times.
Great stuff. So, DK, do you have... I don't know why I'm asking, do you? DK, you have things about the direction, I'm sure, that you want to say.
Yeah. Test audience to whom the movie was initially screened was not told that the movie was intended to be a comedy. Zemeckis and Gale recalled that the atmosphere in the cinema started to get very, very tense during the scene where Einstein the dog is sent through time because they were expecting something gruesome to happen to him. However, once it kicked in during the film kicked in, They loved it. Industrial Light and Magic hadn't completed the final DeLorean shots, and the last several minutes of the movie were previewed in black and white, but it didn't matter because the audience were just roaring in approval at the final scenes anyway. A deleted scene shows Marty peeking in on a class in 55 and seeing his mother cheating on a test. And as Marty's entering his high school in 85, the building appears run down, has been covered with graffiti. But one of the pieces of graffiti reads Lorraine Del Calvin, serving as an Easter egg.
Oh, cool. Yeah, there's I'd be here all day if I get into everything, but there's loads of little things like that. Like, supposedly, if you look at the clock tower at the start of the movie, the little piece that Doc has chipped out of it that he kind of almost falls off is actually missing from it. Which, again, it baffles you when you think they haven't gone back in time yet, and there's a whole paradox and whatever, mm-hmm. but, again, it's a nice little touch. And I'm sure you noticed the reference to Harold Lloyd in the clocks at the beginning, DK?
Definitely,
He's hanging off one of the clock's faces, which serves as a nice kind of homage to a kind of old silent comedy movies, but also is a nice foreshadowing of what's going to happen to Doc at the end of the film, because he's also hanging off the clock little hand there. So, yeah. Little things like that are things that I kind of love in direction. And I only have a few other things that I haven't mentioned. I've got to say, I love the intro skateboard sequence to The Power of Love. It's just so well staged. I love the scenes of Marty, like, realizing that he's in the past and the way that kind of shows you how out of sorts he is with that. There's a scene that I really like, and it's obviously, it's such a small thing, but it's the only scene that I kind of remember of seeing Eric Stoltz being in. So they were obviously always going to film it this way, and it's the scene when Marty realizes who George is in the past, and he kind of just comes into frame. George is facing the side, and Marty's head just comes into frame, and it's a little thing, but it's just little things like that I think that show what a great director Robert Zemeckis can be. Don't watch the Pinocchio remake; it is absolutely dismal. Like I said, all the transitions I love the little references and the Easter eggs and the ticking clocks and. That's it. That's all I have to say about the direction, unless anyone wants to jump in with their own bits and pieces.
Connor, what's your favourite scene?
I already said the cafe, George Biff in the cafe. When I think that's the future, that's the first thing that comes to mind without fail. It's always that. I suppose the Enchantment Under the Sea dance at the end, the whole, you know, get your damn hands off of her in the car. Like, yeah, it's always like the best montagey bits, but it's like freeze frame snapshot moments that come to mind instantly with That's the Future with me. I don't necessarily think of the, you know, Doc getting gunned down or before they go back in time. Sorry, dog. Like, it's not to say I'm a fan of the dog abuse or, you know, the dog could have potentially died in the car once it traveled, but hey, I'm a cat person. So as soon as you're back in time, then the movie begins. But as soon as they're in the past and you just see Doc not trying to date his mum, but also trying to get along with his mum, that's the movie to me.
Okay, cool. See, I've grown up with it so much, and it's such a comfort movie that I know every little scene off by heart, and I could, like I said, everything from the opening with all of the various clocks to, you know, the very end, not sequel setup, but sequel setup. I know every bit of it, and every bit of it's just so charming, and I just love it. I think it's so well directed. So it's amazing to me that Zemeckis can make beautiful films and absolute turd. And I'm not saying which ones are which, but if you look at his filmography, you know what I'm talking about, you know? So, yeah.
It's A Christmas Carol, isn't it?
That's on one of the lists, I'll tell you that much. But yeah.
I just think, it's hard, like you say, Mike, like you, I've watched it so many times. Like, I could, if you wanted me to, I could just recite the whole film from back to front. Like,
same, yeah.
There's just so much of this that, like, there's fun, like, there's humor, there's, you know, action, like, with the whole skateboard chase, you know, you've got the drama, you've got, you know, romance with his mum, very questionable. You've got a lot of interpersonal, you know, scenes, and I just love how it all fits together. There's nothing that seems out of place.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Doesn't seem like it's a comedy movie or it's a science fiction. It's just sort of, it's a very sort of coming of age movie. Like, it's a proper 80s movie. And yeah. I think it's one of the reasons, like, why you say, like, it would be so hard to do again now, because you just can't capture this whole aura again. Like, the fact that it's just, movies then were made with so much more care. Like, yes, they were trying to still shoehorn stuff in, like studio execs tend to do. Yes, they sacked an actor halfway through making it. But there's just so much love in front of and behind the camera that you can just feel it all sort of become this one thing. And I like the relationship with the main characters, his interplay with the secondary characters, and the way he affects the storyline of his own, you know, childhood and conception, basically. Even the, like, the fun little stuff of, like, you know, oh, if you happen to have a kid who sets fire to the living room, well, just, you know, go easy on him. Like, that's, he remembers to do that on the way out before he leaves. Like, he has these nice moments and, you know, gets to know his parents and see them in a different light. And, you know, it's quite a beautiful film as well, like, in terms of that. It's it is a big family film. Like, the crescendo of the dance stuff, I think, is very sort of heartfelt, as much as it is funny and, you know, action-heavy in some places.
Yeah, it's just well-staged, but like I said, it's weird because I would definitely say this is a comedy, but it's not laugh-out-loud funny. It's more just kind of charming. You know, it's one of those, you smile at the jokes as opposed to the cast. But no, I mean, that's one of the reasons, as I say, I encourage everyone to go and check out the documentaries and the various books and things, because you can tell it was a labor of love, and every bit of love that went into the entire trilogy, actually. So like I said, just studying the behind the scenes of it is as enjoyable, almost as well as watching the movies. Because, you know, like I said, it's the story of how this thing got made that was just pure love.
It was the power of love.
It was the power of love. Genius. That would be a great segue, except I'm going on to VFX production design next and not me.
My hand's disappearing. Like, can you help?
So, DK, first of all, did you have anything else on the direction? And secondly, did you have something from the VFX production design?
Yes. Okay. Production design, there's only about 32 visual effect shots in the entire film. Though now common knowledge that originally the time machine was going to be a fridge, and thus one of the reasons why it wasn't chosen, for those people wondering why pizza places in the States now have to put a warning label on the boxes against eating them. The DeLorean was deliberately selected for its general appearance and gull-winged doors in order to make it plausible that people in 1955 would presume it to be an alien spacecraft, and Galen Zemeckis actually received a fan letter from John DeLorean after the film's release, thanking them for immortalising his car in a nice light this time. In fact, after the film's release, body kits were made for DeLoreans to make them look like the time machine.
Apparently you can still get them if you happen to have a DeLorean, yeah. Sweet. I didn't have much else to add.
Is a vastly, like, unreliable car, like, if you own it. But, you know, it's so sought after because of this film. Like, there's a good joke in, I don't know if any of you guys have seen Chuck, of, like, one of the characters buys a DeLorean because he loves Back to the Future, but anytime it goes above 22 miles an hour, it cuts out.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not the greatest of cars, but like you said, it's pure style value, as Doc says, if you're going to build a time machine into a car.
I watched a show the other day. It was like a kind of treasure hunting thing, and they were referring back to the 80s because an incident occurred in the 80s. So the guy dressed up as Marty McFly, and they had a DeLorean. He says, so he sat in the DeLorean, he's driving to his destination, he just says, I just need to get this thing to 88 miles an hour. And then he looked at the dial, and the thing didn't go to 88 miles an hour.
No, it doesn't. No.
Yeah, and he was just like, the movie's lied.
Yeah, it didn't also have time circuits in that you could just press it on. But no. the production design, I mentioned to you a couple of days ago when I was researching this, TK, that I never knew that the DeLorean concept in terms of like outfitting it as a time machine was done at least in part by Andrew Probert, the concept designer, who, amongst other things, designed the Starship Enterprise for Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Which is, oh, wow. What a link.
Well, the link of best worlds for you, Michael. Jesus.
Absolutely.
That's the future in Star Trek. Aside from the whole Planet Vulcan line.
Oh, yeah. Darth Vader from Vulcan. You've got to love that.
Yeah.
And, you mentioned the audience being scared of what might happen to Einstein the dog. In actuality, there was no danger to any dog because Einstein was played by a man in a dog suit during those sequences. Which I didn't know until I looked at the behind the scenes book and saw this man in a full-on dog suit and a woman who apparently, to support him, also had a dog mask on. Very weird. Wow.
Have you been looking at the wrong sites now? Again, Mike.
No. Different kind of dog. But,
back to the dogging.
Other than that, really, all I had was stuff I've already mentioned. I think the prosthetics are very good. I love the flame effect. It's super cool, but my word, it's a bit dated. the way it's, you know, it should really set their shoes on fire. But anyway. So I'm going to move to the music and sound because we're, you know, time's ironically catching up with us. And I'm just going to quickly say what I've got because it's only one, like, little line in there, which is just to say, I can't add anything other than to say this is the best soundtrack ever. Power of Love, Back in Time, Silvestri's iconic theme, Earth Angel, Johnny Be Good, Mr. Sandman. It's probably my favorite soundtrack out of all movie soundtracks, and I like a lot of them. TK, music and sound, take it away. I'm sure you have some.
Spielberg initially had some reservations about hiring Alan Silvestri, having been unimpressed by his score for Romancing the Stone. During a preview screening, which the film was accompanied by a temporary track that only was part of Silvestri's score, Spielberg commented to Zemeckis that a particularly grand cue was the sort of music the film needed, unaware that it was indeed one of Silvestri's cues. Huey Lewis was asked by Zemeckis and Gale to write a song for the film. However, both Bobs were not thrilled with the first song Huey brought back to them. After explaining what they were hoping for, he came back with The Power of Love. He was then told they needed one more song, and so upon viewing a cut of the film, Huey got the inspiration for Back in Time. And finally, Michael J. Fox's singing. It was actually performed by Mark Campbell, who was known in the States, at least, in the 80s as lead singer of the band Jack Mack and the Heart Attack. And the only thing I really know him from is the title music from Police Academy, the main theme. So
there's a claim to fame. And yes, just for the members of the audience that will put it in the comments if I don't mention it, yes, I do recognise Huey Lewis has a cameo as one of the judges in the Battle of the Bands thing at the start. It's pretty easy to recognise him. So, yeah, I'm sure you all knew that. Right, so an audience interaction section, which we always do, you know, where we post on our social medias asking the audience what they think of these movies. But first of all, I do have a very special person who wants to give their opinions on this, and I really hope this works. So we'll see. Alexa, what's your favourite movie?
My all-time favourite film would have to be Back to the Future. It's a flawless, family-friendly cinema magic. Great Scott!
There we go.
Is it bad that for a minute there, he's actually had a message back from one of the people in Back to the Future?
I wish. Oh man, I wish.
We're gonna get Bob Gale out from under the desk.
Have a lot of audience response. A few things from Facebook and the majority from Letterboxd, because a lot of people just didn't want to reply, presumably because it's one of those films where it's kind of redundant and everybody knows, you know, it's beloved, I guess. So I'll give you those, and then I know, DK, you have a piece of audience response that you want to finish with.
Yeah.
I'll start us off then and see. I wish. My personal Facebook page, Dave Morland says, one of my favorite films growing up, love the end scene with the lightning. Then he has an emoji of a car and a lightning bolt. From the Silver Screen Podcast group on Facebook, Jeff Tilley says, for me, it's the perfect 5 out of 5 film. From the beginning with the walls of clocks, the movie had character. The ludicrous amplifier told us this was going to be fun and silly, and Marty's pluck of the guitar strings confirmed the popcorn rating of this film. So that's, I think, all I have from Facebook. So, like I said, moving on to some sort of mutual friends on Letterboxd. AfSinX simply gave it 5 stars and says, this one is an absolute classic. Maverick gives it 5 stars and says, this one's a classic. Mr. _Z give it 5 stars and says, aren't you a sight for sore eyes? This movie is a perfect pick-me-up film. It's upbeat, great music, stellar cast and acting, and another one of the great all-time movies. Spielberg cannot be beat. He and this time with Zemeckis make one of the most exciting movies to ever grace the screen. Clacker the Geek has quite a detailed thing. He gives it 5 stars and says, okay, let's review my absolute favorite film of all time. The film is just perfect. The story is so ingenious. The script is so witty, clever, charming, and fantastic. The characters are great. Marty and Doc are complete polar opposites, which makes them so great. Marty being a good audience surrogate, as we said, and a foil to Doc's craziness. But the chemistry between Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd is one of, if not the best, on-screen chemistry between two actors on film. It's perfect, and you instantly love them. The repeated gags are really cool, showing the theme of history repeating and having things like Marty meeting his parents and his mum fancying him, which is hilarious. Biff is a really good, pretty intimidating antagonist. The set design, production, visual effects, music, and emotional beats are nothing short of magical and top-notch. The finale is just perfection, and I have the biggest grin on my face every time I watch it. I don't think I've seen anyone who actively dislikes this film, and how could you? Indeed. Sam McGillivray, sorry if I've mispronounced that, Back to the Future gives it 4 stars and says, Back to the Future was a classic film and among the all-time greats in the sci-fi genre and likely the best time travel movie ever made. This film alone has kept the DeLorean relevant for the last 30 years. The script is so well done that many writing classes at the collegiate level have it included in their curriculum. If you have children, this is basically a requirement for viewing, you know, if they want to know who invented the skateboard and rock and roll. Lordly Kicker also gives it 4 stars and says, first time watching and I can see why it's a classic. Never imagined this film as being the foundation of incest porn though. Okay. Alex Marzonia gives it 5 stars and just says, it's just freaking perfectly made. Mike _Lord gives it 5 stars and says, it's been a few years since I last watched this and even longer since I watched it in isolation without a rewatch of the whole trilogy. I enjoy the whole thing, but it has to be said the original movie does stand up rather well as a self-contained film in its own right, and it's the most authentically 80s movie of the trilogy. The sequels feel manufactured in comparison, which I suppose they were. Paul DeNuzio gave it 5 stars and says, my daughter came home from school and wanted to watch this one, and my son, who's not really a big movie guy, expressed interest, so who was I to argue? It had certainly been a while, but dang, it's like a good friend. Every time I watch, I slide back into the film comfortably like an old pair of jeans or a baggy sweatshirt. The film is just liquid gold. It's got such heart. It has great nostalgia for a few different eras. It has great performances from Fox, Lloyd, Glover, and more. It's a film you don't have to worry about time travel loopholes or continuity issues. The team behind the film did concern themselves, and even if there are some gaps, you know the film was made out of love. One of the ultimate family films, it's a film that felt as fresh in 2019 as it did in 1985, even as we saw so much out of date. Oh yeah, and my son loved it. One of those films that will always put a smile on my face. Whew. Super Bardi Brothers gives it 5 stars and says, I watched it so many times as a kid and had to introduce the wifey to the franchise, and she absolutely loved it. The last set piece at the clock tower worked so well, but the backbone of this movie are the many emotional character beats. Doc and Marty's relationship, Lorraine crushing on Marty, George standing up to Biff, the reveal at the end that Doc is alive. I realize now that it's more of a high school comedy than a time travel movie, and that's probably why the movie became such a big hit when it came out. Our brains weren't ready for the time beep in part two. JA Productions, Jamie, who you may know from our Discord and from guesting on here a few times, also gives it 5 stars and says, Back to the Future is my absolute favorite film. I know it's quite a common pick for the best, but I don't care. So much about it is amazing, from the music to the cinematography and effects to the acting of all of the leads. Marty is instantly likable and is also quite relatable, as he's just a regular teenager with a love interest, which is something most people can relate to. This is contrasted well with Doc Brown being the eccentric scientist, which you can't relate to. So when you're confused about something, you're confused with Marty. Biff also works as a villain in the film, and he gets his just desserts at the end. However, he's definitely better in the second film. Would I recommend this film? Duh, obviously I would. I literally have no problems with it and happily rewatch it every year. You know a film is iconic when it is still referenced today.
This is from Timeless Journey, who does the music for my cult classics show. They say, I grew up with this one. In fact, this was the movie that introduced me to the concept of time travel and the consequences of such long before I ever experienced Doctor Who. Not only is it super fun with some truly memorable dialogue that helps identify future friends and some fantastic music, but it's just a stone cold classic. One of my favourite all-time movies, and they give it 5 stars.
Awesome. Fantastic. You'll have to thank her for leaving that a bit of feedback. And yes, suffice to say, very popular. I don't think we had a negative bit of that. So, yeah, all that remains now is for us to crank up our DeLorean and give our favourite character moment line and then our conclusion and score. First of all, we'll start and ask everyone's favourite character. We'll go around and we'll start with you, Connor. Who's your favourite character and why?
Biff. I think I'll say Biff.
Really?
No, it's either between Biff or Crispin Glover. George. Yeah, it's either between George or Biff.
I was not expecting that. Okay, why? Why Biff?
Well, no, not because he calls everyone a butthead. It's just, I don't really honestly have a reason. It's just Biff
entertainment
just brings
really,
a smile to my face.
Okay,
huh?
Cool. Just entertainment value, I think, is probably what you were getting at.
More.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
That's more or less. But again, without George McFly and George in real life on screen with him, it ain't the same, obviously. So, yeah, the two of them are the thing that makes the movie for me, as well as Michael J. Fox and Doc Brown. But, you know, it's George McFly and Biff that help give it that extra bit of steam for me anyway. But, yeah.
Very unique, fair enough. What about you, George?
Einstein.
The dog.
No, like, I've said it to death, like, obviously, like Marty McFly. Like, I'm transitioning in my real life from, you know, my Marty McFly days are long behind me, and I'm in my George McFly era now. I have my own Marty McFly to deal with. And, like,
that's heavy, man.
Yeah, that's heavy. But, you know, there's a reason this man is my hero, like, outside of this film. Like, he, like, played a character that, you know, I love so dearly. Like, this film is so precious to me. Like, it's something that my dad showed me. I will show my son when...
Oh, yes, you will.
You know, not, you know, just interested in Bluey, which, obviously, that's the stage we're at. But,
yeah.
It's one of those films that you have to see at some point in your life before you die. Like, I know that those lists are somewhat dramatic. Like, you must see this film, but this is such a snapshot of the 80s, and it's still so relevant now, and it's down to the lead. Like, the reason, like, he is our audience surrogate. Like, Marty brings us into this story, his relationship with Doc Brown, as we said before, you know, this film lives or dies on it, and it dances a fantastic dance through the time and space continuum. Yes, they can invent a time machine, but can't invent a way to leave Hill Valley. But we look past it. We look past it because this film has heart, it has soul, it's funny, it's witty. And a lot of that comes from this character who, obviously, he's like seen as cool in his time, but he has to do a lot of thinking on his feet and sort of be a bit pragmatic and be a bit practical. Like, he has to dress up as Darth Vader from Vulcan. He has to, like, make all these things happen because in his head he's like, I've messed up the first meeting. I need to do this. I need to think of something to get them together, to get them near each other. We'll take them to the dance. We'll do this. I'll pose as this. I'll try and molest my mother and then you'll beat me up. Like, it's all those, like, he's very practical. He's very hands-on. He's a lot of fun. He's just one of those characters I don't think you get a lot in films these days. And he's played so well by a man who I wish could live forever. Like, I really do. Because for me, this is Tom Baker levels of, like, when something bad happens, I feel like the world stops for this one.
Yeah.
Like, it's such an influential film. He is such
an influential
man.
You say that, but in a way, through the movies, won't they always live forever?
Oh, yeah, like, that is the magic of these movies, that, like, we get these people that in front and behind the camera have made this, you know, labour of love, and we get to cherish this forever. And I hope to God, at least in my lifetime, nothing is ever rebooted of this. No, I don't want Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Holland to do this. No, I don't want anyone else. Just let this be. Like, this is one of the very rare perfect films, I think, in cinema. And that's all I really have to say on it, without crying.
It's bad enough that it inspired Rick and Morty. Let's not have anything else made out of it.
No, and it has a fantastic musical, which you should see.
Okay, cool. I will say something
although we sort of, I retracted the statement, but I said there's something that in, on my head wouldn't have been made or shouldn't have been a musical, like even as a second, but I can concur with George's statement, like it's a thrilling experience.
This story is just timeless and fits in anything.
It really does. Cool. Before I ask DK and myself our favorite character, I will say, kind of piggybacking off something you said, George, that I have to mention, I had the honor of being the one to introduce the film to my nephew when he was around 8 or 9 years old. He's 18 now. So brilliant. He absolutely loved it straight away. First time he saw it. I was a bit gutted. I never got the chance to introduce my little brother to it because he's like 17 years younger than me. But the reason I didn't get to is because school did it. Like, he watched it at school when he was like 6 years old. And I was like, damn, they're finally teaching these kids the important stuff.
Yes.
True cinema. Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, DK, who was your favourite character and why?
It'd be Marty, hasn't it? He's rightfully remembered for this role. I think George has
kind of explained why,
he's just perfect for this role.
No, fine.
Not at all.
I'd have said the same, Marty. He's the main character, he's who you identify with, and it's probably one of, if not the best performance in film, I think. The perfect marriage of character and actor, so I agree. With everything George said as well.
So, would you dare say Marty McFly is probably the greatest or one of the greatest movie protagonists of all time? Like, well,
definitely, yeah. He's definitely up
there. He's at least top three.
Yeah. Top three.
I'm sure if there is such a list that he's on it. So we'll maybe look that up later. So, we're going to go around and ask everyone's favourite moment. And again, Connor, I'll start with you. What's your favourite moment or scene in the movie?
Cafe. I don't want to keep saying the cafe.
You kind of did mention the cafe thing.
Yeah, I know. I've had it on sort of loosely in the background, but sort of listening and not paying too much attention. Something else that stands out. I mean, everything stands out. George basically standing up to Biff, the whole car scene, the initial seduction scene between Marty and his mum, and the whole, this doesn't feel, it's like kissing my brother, or that whole sequence between Marty and then Biff, and then George getting the comeuppance, good, overcoming evil, there's nothing like it. And it was just a good feel good, like, yes, justice is served scene.
Cool. Okay. What about you, George?
I'm trying to think of something that we haven't mentioned, because it's weird, like you're saying, what's your favorite scene in Back to the Future? Like, when someone says, what's like your favorite book you've ever read? And you suddenly forget every book you've ever read.
You blur on the spot.
I want to kind of go for, I might go for the opening. Like, the way it starts really sets the tone of the whole thing. Like, the clocks, him going into the lab, like, he's obviously let himself in, so there's a relationship between these two, and you immediately just get a sense of him, like who Marty is as a character, and you get a sense of their relationship together, like, with not much being said, like, that when he goes to Twin Pines Mall, that there's something that's already there, like when you get to that whole iconic scene with the DeLorean for the first time, that there's shared history with these guys, and like, you get the whole late for school stuff, like, and there's the fun campiness and the kids part of this movie kind of thing, playing up to the, the teens, late for school, skateboarding to school kind of thing. Like,
it's probably something that's a bit obvious to mention, but I think the power of love just goes with that scene so well.
And the way it builds to that as well, it's kind of like, it's slow, and then it's kind of like late for school, that the beat kicks in and then he's there, and then you're just into the movie, like it's kind of like a sort of just slowly introducing these things, and here we go, straight to the story, let's get on with it. And this film doesn't waste a second of screen time, like everything is like to a T, whether it be the music, whether it be what we're seeing, like everything to the minute, to the second, is just like used to perfection, and just great. It's one of them films, like, when you sit down and you watch it and you wonder where the time's gone.
Yeah, like, for sure.
Just start it and then just you finish it because it's just,
absolutely
it just
intended, yeah.
Is absorbed yeah. into you. So, yeah, I'll go for the beginning because it awesome. Started it all. That's the yeah. first thing I saw, and I was like, yeah, I'm sold. Let's do this. Let's watch this 75 times until I die. Let's go.
I can definitely see why you would say that. It's a good choice, and it will probably be my second or third choice. What about you, DK? What was your favourite moment or scene?
I'm going to go towards the end, the clock tower, and trying to get Marty home in the car. The car.
Another great choice.
Yeah, it's freaking heart-pounding, that. The editing on that section is just beautiful.
And like I said, the way that everything just keeps on going wrong, from the wire breaking to the car not starting to, you know, every little thing, to the dock ripping up the...
Good.
Absolutely. My favourite moment, I said, was everything from the hero kiss moment when George stands up to the other guy, and then Marty basically jumps back into life, does the triumphant Johnny B. Good, and you get the, it's your cousin Marvin Berry gag. I think that entire section, I think, is perfection. Just great. Again, iconic and parodied so many places. So finally, until we get to our conclusion, do you have a favourite line? And I'm aware that's difficult because there's so many. Connor, can you shout out a favourite line from the movie at all?
going by the internet, the character's name is Skinhead, but hey, Biff, get a load of this guy's life preserver. Don't think he's going to drown.
Nice, good call. What about you, George?
What the hell is a gigawatt?
Random, but okay, cool. What about you, TK?
Jesus, George, it's a wonder I was even born.
and
I went with the line because I just think it's such a killer last line. Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
That is the coolest last line ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Badass line.
Tell
me, Doctor, where are we going this time?
Just to, before we strike our cars with lightning and end up back in a hopefully improved future, we just have to give our conclusions and our scores out of 5 stars. And again, I'll start with you guys because you're the guests. And so, Connor, do you have a conclusion and a score out of 5 for me?
I mean, score-wise, it's a 5. I mean, like, we keep beating around the bush. Of course, it's going to be a 5-star. A conclusion, the first of arguably the perfect trilogy, at least for us sci-fi movie fans. I always go back and forth, though, between this and Part 2, like, which I prefer, because, again, the whole future aspect I prefer, he literally goes back to the future. Yes, I know 2015's way long and gone, and it's kind of irrelevant now, because we've kind of lived that, and, half of it didn't really happen. But constant back and forth between 1 and 2, but I just love these movies, and no matter how many times or handful of times I've watched them, every time I watch it, it always is a treat and an occasion, and it's only amplified by, again, the musical theater experience, and just, again, every time me and George have a conversation, Back to the Future comes up, it's always a yes, tell me more, I want to know more. I mean, I haven't gone in depth into the whole Eric Stoll back, like, behind the scenes documentary stuff as I need to do with so many other movies I own, but that's why I like doing these with you guys, because you kind of tell me things that I hadn't really thought of, and you guys give me the inside scoop.
Cool, that's good. A lot of the audience are finding it the same way, but yeah, like I said, if I recommend one thing, though, it would definitely be the ultimate visual history book of Back to the Future. Because it's just so comprehensive and it fills you in on every behind the scenes of all the trilogy. So, yeah, definitely recommend that for you if you have a chance to buy it or find it cheap. So, George, what about your conclusion and score, please?
What can I say that's not been said? It's my favourite film of all time. It's one of the best films of all time and one of the greatest trilogies of all time. It is a big comfort blanket. I can watch it day, night, winter, summer, like any time. If it's on ITV4, you bet I'll watch it from the second ad break onwards. Like, I can consume this in any way. Like, I can half pay attention to it. I can sit down and give it my full focus and still get the same, if not more, enjoyment out of it each time and find something new in it to love. And I will love this film forever. That's basically it. Like, that's all I can say. Like, I'm always gonna watch this film. I'll show it to my kids, I'll show it to whoever, I'll show it to random people in the street if I have to.
Cool.
It's a movie that will stick with me forever, and I'm eternally thankful for Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Bob Gale, Spielberg, and Robert Zemeckis for, you know, the fantastic work that they gifted us, and we get to enjoy it forever and ever. 5 stars, nice. 5 out of 5, 100%, it's the best.
Awesome. I gathered. I'm probably going to go next then, because I've got it written down and ready to say here. And I said, there's a reason this is considered by many to be one of the greatest movies ever made. Actually, there are many reasons, many of which I'm sure you know if you've seen it. It's charming, it's well-written, it's lightning in a bottle, no pun intended. From the pitch-perfect casting to the little moments and Easter eggs, everything just pops. It's a modern-day fairy tale where at the end of a series of adventures, the good people emerge triumphant and get rewarded, while the bad people are vanquished and get their comeuppance. Along the way, characters even learn to overcome their own weaknesses to achieve greater things and live happily ever after. In other words, it's a wish fulfillment fantasy of how we feel life should be. That's comforting and enjoyable, made more so by all the fun along the way. The clever plotting also helps you to feel engaged and enthused. It feels good to revisit, and it's one of a handful of films that I never get tired of and even like a little more each time I revisit it. Don't ever remake it. It's a perfect time capsule and a flawless piece of entertainment that still appeals to anyone and everyone. In the 80s, we were ready for this, and our kids and their kids are still going to love it. And I also gave it 5 stars. So, no pressure, Dick.
Yeah.
Period, then. That was great.
Yeah, most, I mean, let's be honest, Mike. I mean, most movies you look here, especially from this era, they do have some issues, some elements that haven't aged well. What was, you know, once considered a classic becomes downgraded over time. This isn't one of them. If Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd and company had made no other films, they should rightfully be proud of this one. From the script to the acting to the soundtrack, this, along with its sequels, is unadulterated perfection. Nothing else needs to be said, really. 5 out of 5.
Oh, wow!
Beautiful!
That is incredible. Well, again, I don't have to work hard to work out the average. And this is incredible. With 4 people here, it somehow still comes to a perfect... 5 out of 5. Absolutely unbelievable and thoroughly deserved. That's brilliant. Excellent work, guys. I'm thrilled about that because, as I say, I do genuinely love this movie. It's one of my top 3, so I'm happy. So, yeah. Before we make like a tree and get out of here, then, all that remains to do
it's
is
leave,
to
you idiot. Make like a tree and leave. You sound like a damn fool when you say it wrong.
I knew you were going to do that. Just remains for me to say thank you to our guests from Pasty Sheep Nerd Bible, George and Connor. Does either of you want to shout out where people can find you on the internet? I know that you're either coming back or just have come back by the time this comes out.
Oh, yes, we will be back by the time this comes out. Woohoo! Time travel. nerdbiblecontact@gmail.com if you want to get involved. Actually, Connor, you normally do this bit, don't you? So you should do it.
Yeah, well, again, you guys, I mean... Again, we lose count of how many episodes we've done, but I mean, everyone that uses a smartphone kind of knows your shtick. You know, your Facebook, your TikTok, your Twitters, Instagram. You know where to find us. You know where to find the Silver Screen podcast. Links will be in the description somewhere or eventually on the screen once we're all good at editing. You know, please do the whole like, sharing, commenting for this film in particular. It is one of the true, like, finest pieces of media going. And again, if anyone... whether you're a movie goer or not, if you've somehow not experienced at least the first movie of this trilogy, then what are you doing? Like, what are you actually doing? Get someone to watch it with you. Get some random person on the street. At least consume it once. And then your future will be intact going forward.
Yep. Just get it in the best
future is
you can.
Whatever you make it. So make exactly. It a good one.
Entirely. Yeah, absolutely. You can find the guys, as I say, I think under Pasty Sheep, most social medias, just look for that and you'll find them. We will have on screen, if I remember to edit it in, which I have so far, fingers crossed, a graphic that will show you all the places you can find us on the internet. Feel free to pause the video and look at that if you'd like. Again, I'm not going over the whole thing every episode, but it's all there for you. And it's also in our link tree, which you can find in the episode descriptions, either on YouTube or wherever podcast catcher you're listening to us on. And yeah, that's about it. Just DK, how are you feeling? Anything you want to just quickly say before we go?
No, been good.
awesome.
May I offer my congratulations, gentlemen, in your passing of your 500 subscribers? Very well done.
Thank
indeed.
You. Thank you. It's actually up to 521 already at this point.
523. I just checked to make sure I was
right.
Oh
wow. Okay.
God damn. Cool.
Like, you honestly, like, it's a joy to be on it, but it's also a joy to listen to. Like, you guys do a great job.
Thank you.
Please continue your support for this amazing podcast. And Michael will be with us at some point. Well, I don't know when. I forget when your episode is.
It's the episode Dot and Bubble of Doctor Who that I'm reviewing. So whenever that comes out, a week or so within that air date, I'll probably be with you.
Exactly. But continue the support. Well done, guys. And thanks for having us back on. Always a pleasure.
Anytime. No, anytime. Thanks for coming. And thanks for discussing the film with such passion and joie de vie. So, yeah, I mean, there's nothing else to say, really, is there? Except do join us again. We will be back soon with another new episode, I believe, in a couple of weeks' time, possibly a top 10 episode. And you might actually hear George again on that one. But we'll wait.
It's me. I'm Bob Gale under the desk.
thanks for joining us. If you've stuck with us for this, hopefully you've enjoyed it and got something out of it. And it's a movie that, like I said, if you haven't seen it, just to echo Connor, please do watch it with the nice snacks and whatever, and maybe revisit this podcast. And it's always a joy to revisit this movie and its making. So hopefully, like I said, you've had a good time and you'll continue to join us for future episodes of the Silver Screen Podcast. And just remember, until next time, great Scott, Marty. We've got to go back to the future.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.